This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, May 7th, 2009. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Wendy Carrillo, sitting in for Ahora Abogado. Bank stress tests reveal some banks are not healthy enough to survive another economic meltdown. We go to Georgia, where after last year's war with Russia, tens of thousands remain displaced. And thousands of Gazans continue to lack access to water 4 months after the Israeli attacks. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Maryland has become the first state in the U.S. to make attacks targeting homeless people a hate crime. The state's governor, Martin O'Malley, signed the bill into law today. Michael O'Neill, director of the Faces of Homelessness Speakers Bureau, says many oppose this sort of legislation, their argument being, because homelessness is a choice, the addition of the group would water down current hate crimes legislation, which traditionally targets people who have no control over their minority status. But, he says, the numbers speak to the need.
From 1999 to 2007, there's been 774 documented attacks in this country and 217 deaths. And hopefully with Maryland doing it, other states will follow suit.
O'Neill says California, Ohio, Texas, and Massachusetts are all considering similar legislation. Advocacy groups are also pushing for change on the federal level. Activists in Brownsville, Texas today held a vigil in solidarity with detainees at the Port Isabel Detention Center. Their inmates have been on hunger strike for nearly 2 weeks in protest of the conditions at the facility. Ansel Herz has an update.
Initially, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials denied that any detainees were on hunger strike, but family members and activists have since confirmed to FSRN up to 200 people are participating. Now, ICE acknowledges at least one detainee is striking. Anianza Garza of the Southwest Workers Union says the detainees are taking turns on hunger strike in order to maintain their health.
It's a federal facility, but they contract out to a corporation for the guards. So these guards and ICE officials have been participating in verbal and physical abuse of the detainees.
Activists met with local congressmen 2 days ago to make them aware of the situation at the facility, and they say they are preparing a national day of action in solidarity with the detainees on hunger strike. Ansel Herz, FSRN, Austin.
In the waning hours of the Colorado legislative session, lawmakers could not muster enough votes to repeal the death penalty. From Denver, Nikki Kaiser reports.
Ultimately, the measure to eliminate the death penalty failed by one vote in the Senate. Capital punishment opponents were hopeful because of the unique approach taken in the legislation. It sought to redirect funds for capital cases to the investigation of coal cases. Abe Bonowitz with the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
I'm not aware of another state that is taking this approach. Really, what was important is helping legislators see that it really wasn't a big deal, that the death penalty wasn't being used very much, that when it was used, it had more to do with politics and geography than the severity of the crime.
Four Colorado state Democrats joined Republicans to defeat the bill. District attorneys opposed the legislation, citing a need for plea bargain material, and said life in prison is not a sufficient deterrent. Supporters of abolition, including families of murder victims, the Catholic Church, and public defenders, say they will propose the bill again next year. Nikki Kaiser, FSRN, Denver.
The U.S. Justice Department has decided not to pursue a second court-martial trial for Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first U.S. military officer to refuse service in Iraq. FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield has more from Seattle.
The Department of Justice has asked the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to dismiss their appeal of a lower court ruling which blocked a second court-martial trial for Lieutenant Aaron Watada. In June 2006, Lieutenant Watada refused to serve in Iraq on the grounds that the U.S. invasion was both illegal and immoral. His court-martial was declared a mistrial in February 2007. A civilian U.S. federal judge blocked the Army's attempt to hold a second court-martial in October of 2007, ruling that a second trial would qualify as double jeopardy. According to the U.S. Constitution, a person cannot be tried twice on the same charges. Although Lieutenant Watada's period of enlistment was up 2 years ago, he is still virtually confined to the U.S. Army base at Fort Lewis, Washington, where he's stationed. Watada has not been allowed to leave military service, and the U.S. Army has barred him from communicating with anti-war groups. Despite the Department of Justice's decision not to appeal the earlier civilian court ruling, the U.S. Army is still considering prosecution of Lieutenant Watada on two charges of behavior unbecoming an officer, because of an anti-war speech he gave to the Veterans for Peace National Conference in Seattle in 2006. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
As President Obama continues to meet with Pakistani and Afghan leaders in Washington, the situation in both countries is rapidly deteriorating. In southern Afghanistan today, a suicide bomber targeting foreign troops killed 12 civilians and injured over 30 more. In addition, fallout continues from U.S. airstrikes this week, which killed nearly 100 civilians. In response, residents have staged protests. Today, police opened fire on a group of demonstrators, injuring six. U.S. and Afghan authorities are currently investigating the airstrikes. In Pakistan, the government said today it will end the peace deal with the Taliban and step up its military operations against the militant group. The government says currently over 10,000 troops are in the Swat Valley. The relief agency Doctors Without Borders said today it has halted emergency medical work in Swat because of the extreme insecurity and incidents targeting the group's aid workers. The organization claims hundreds of thousands of Pakistanis are currently seeking refuge. And finally, China says more than 5,000 school children died in last year's major earthquake in Sichuan province. The announcement comes almost a full year after the anniversary. Many parents of the dead blame corruption and poor school construction for the classroom collapses that trapped and killed so many students. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The much-anticipated bank stress test results are in today, and after 2 months analyzing the 19 largest banks' books, the government's assessments reveal that some of those banks are not healthy enough to survive any additional economic stress. That means the government will force the banks to raise more money. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from the Capitol.
Like a doctor conducting a physical, the government has been examining banks' balance sheets to determine their health. Leaks to the Wall Street Journal reveal that half of the 19 largest banks are unhealthy, but their condition is not chronic, says Doug Redeker with the New America Foundation.
We've now established that the financial system is going to survive.
Banks will survive, but are in need of some medicine. Wells Fargo needs a dose of $15 billion. Bank of America needs $35 billion. Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, and State Street Corp, and about half of the banks tested, also need money for financial stability. J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Bank of Mellon Corp, and others don't need more capital. It's a much better scenario than analysts predicted.
If these banks do X, Y, and Z, they will survive, and the system itself can continue as was the case previously. That's a lot different than saying all is well, everything's healthy, and let's get on with business as usual.
Doug Redeker with New America Foundation says banks determined able to survive could lead to more detriment.
Business as usual is what got the world financial system into the problems that it's in the first place. So you really have to decide whether deciding that things are not as bad as we thought they were in November, December, and January is actually the sum total of what's needed.
The banks were required to meet a government-imposed standard that they have enough capital to continue with its business under more severe economic times. The unhealthy banks will have three options. The first is to convert preferred stocks to common stocks, which act like general operating money. The second option is to raise capital in the private sector. And third, to take more money from the government. They have 30 days to come up with a plan and 6 months to implement it. Nomi Prim, senior fellow at Demos, a public policy organization, says the stress tests have not revealed anything new because the struggling banks have already shown distress.
And those are the ones that have done the worst in stock value. Those are the ones that have had the most losses. Those are the ones who have continued to borrow the most from the Fed. Those are the ones whose TARP injections that we've been putting in and started in last October have performed the worst.
She says the Federal Reserve is trying to get a handle on the situation of the banks, something they were supposed to do consistently during crisis and not.
These stress tests are a way to act proactive reactively.
The government has $110 billion left in TARP money for banks. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Homeowners and borrowers have moved one step closer to getting more protection from predatory lending. The Mortgage Reform and Anti-Predatory Lending Act passed in the House today would make it more difficult for home buyers to get pushed into applying for a loan they wouldn't be able to afford in the long run. But tougher regulations could mean smaller lenders may go out of business, and fewer mortgage companies could mean increased lending costs to consumers. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
The act includes requiring lenders to prove borrowers can repay and prohibits lenders from steering consumers into high-interest loans. Dennis Cardoza, Democrat from California.
H.R. 1728 is not a cure for the foreclosure crisis, but it is an important component in eliminating the unscrupulous practices that ran amok and helped lead the collapse of the housing market.
The bill says there must be a benefit to a consumer if a loan is refinanced and stops the practice of a lender giving an interest rate higher than the lowest rate the consumer qualifies for. In addition, the legislation also includes provisions that Republicans find particularly troubling. First, creditors that make a subprime loan must retain a 5% interest in the loan, and second, that the act expands the types of loans that could be considered predatory. Republicans say this could open the door for more lawsuits. Pete Sessions, Republican from Texas.
We're going to now create qualified mortgages which require lenders to hold 5% credit. So what we're going to do is limit choice, reduce credit, and increase cost, and make sure now there's a slush fund for trial lawyers to sue the same companies that we were trying to encourage to go make lend and lend to the marketplace so people could have money.
Vice President of the Independent Community Bankers of America, Ike Jones, says bankers see the lawsuit fear factor as a real one.
They don't want to have seen put in place the possibility that you get sued for technical violations or because a statute now views what was a safe product in the hands of community bankers is now considered an unsafe product, and that's just not the case.
Jones says the legislation might cut down on what's available for consumers.
I mean, right now, is pretty much only available is 30-year fixed-rate mortgages, but we have a very, very extremely low interest rate environment, the lowest in my lifetime in 50 years, but that's not going to last forever. And so that's why you need the ability to use ARMs and other safe products that have been safe in the past.
But this opposition was expected by public interest advocates. Keith Corbett is vice president for the Center for Responsible Lending.
There is no empirical evidence. I mean, the people who oppose the bill are just blowing smoke because there is no evidence that that would happen. It was always the same argument that this is going to cost the cost of credit going up. And so that's a classic argument that the industry makes, actually, and the Republicans actually buy into it.
Corbett says the legislation will provide protections for consumers from both small and big lenders. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
President Obama unleashed the details of his budget and is highlighting $17 billion in program cuts for 2010. Half of the cuts come from the Defense Department. Republicans respond that the cuts make up just 0.25% of the budget total of $3.6 trillion. But at least one group is celebrating. Black farmers. President Obama included $1.25 billion to pay black farmers for years of discrimination at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The farmers won a civil rights lawsuit against the USDA and have been waiting for the remainder of the monetary payment.
This is a huge step in the right direction. And although there's not enough funding on the table currently,
that's National Black Farmers Association President John Boyd. He warns $1.25 billion would not pay every farmer owed, and that another $1.5 billion is necessary to pay out all 75,000 black farmers.
I worked all these years. I just don't want to see anybody left out.
The payment to black farmers and the rest of the budget must first pass Congress, which is expected to begin scrubbing the budget immediately. Authorities in Georgia have released three activists accused of hooliganism after they protested outside the offices of what protesters said were pro-government journalists. The country's interior ministry said the opposition protesters were released after the leader of the Georgian Orthodox Church made an appeal to the government. Meanwhile, a second meeting planned between Georgia, Russia, and South Ossetia has been canceled. South Ossetia belongs to Georgia, but has long been under separatist control and is backed by Russia. The province South Ossetia was at the center of a short war between Georgia and Russia in August. 130,000 people fled their homes to escape the fighting. Of those, about 30,000 who had lived in the province of South Ossetia are still unable to return. Many now live in hastily constructed settlements and remain dependent on foreign aid. They make up only the latest addition to the more than 200,000 people already displaced by wars fought over Georgia's breakaway provinces. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
The settlement of Skraw is a cluster of 86 cottages near the city of Gori in central Georgia. Gardens have been planted in small plots, but it's no substitute for farms left behind in South Ossetia. 51-year-old Marab is in his garden, turning over the hard soil with a shovel. He's trying to make it work, but doesn't sound optimistic.
The soil is very bad here. I want to plant food, but if there's no water for irrigation, it's not going to work.
His neighbor Vaktang echoes his frustration.
We need work. We get macaroni, we get rice, but what we need is work.
Skraw is a rural settlement. Its single-story cottages have relatively large garden plots, but nowhere near enough space for subsistence farming. Add the lack of jobs, and there's a feeling of desperation from people who have gone from being prosperous farmers to dependent on the United Nations for basic food staples. Lola Castro coordinates the UN's World Food Program in Georgia.
For the people in the new settlements and the collective centers, they are basically dependent on food aid at this moment, and also cash transfers that we, WFP, and other UN agencies and the government are giving to them for complementary foods.
From a distance, these settlements resemble rows of condominiums. The largest of these settlements have more than 2,000 houses. The majority lack indoor plumbing, and sanitation is a concern. Minister for Accommodation and Refugees, Koba Subliani, says the government is working towards sustainability for these internally displaced persons, known as IDPs.
All the IDPs in the rural settlements have small plots of land that they can use to grow enough food for their families. And the IDPs living in the urban centers, they have the same chance for employment as anyone else.
The current Georgian government's rapid building project stands in stark contrast with what past governments have done for people who lost their homes in territorial wars. For about 16 years, some 200,000 people who fled Abkhazia and South Ossetia have since languished in so-called temporary housing complexes. But the Georgian government has pledged to resettle these displaced people by 2011. Some see this as a tacit admission of facts on the ground. After last August's five-day war, both Abkhazia and South Ossetia declared full independence, with Russia guaranteeing their military security. Suzanne Murray-Jones of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees said the bright side is that the first wave of displaced people are finally getting attention.
It's made a window of opportunity that we are all trying to capitalize on now, because we've been working here since the early 90s, UNHCR, but nobody was interested, no one, in helping these people that have been displaced.
The international community pledged $4.5 billion in aid during a post-war donor conference. About a third of the money has already been delivered. The Georgian government estimates it needs $576 million to resettle its IDPs. But with almost no jobs and little arable land in the new settlements, there are worries that these communities will fail. Murray Jones says UNHCR is telling the Georgian government that providing shelter for people won't be enough.
If the people don't have income, it's not going to last very long. If they have no means of upkeeping their houses, they may own them, but they need to have income to be able to maintain those houses.
Ulia Karashvili, a liaison between Georgia's refugee ministry and foreign governments, says that those displaced last summer are caught in the middle of a political conflict that has little to do with them.
They are not politicians, they are normal rural population. They are peasants, they are people who want just to work their lands and to live in peaceful settlement, nothing more.
Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Tbilisi.
Israel launched 3 airstrikes on what it says are smuggling tunnels that connect Gaza with Egypt. Palestinian doctors say 4 people were injured from the strike. The attack came in response to 5 mortar shells fired by Gaza's arm wing of the Hamas party into southern Israel. Meanwhile, the United Nations has hinted that it may reconsider war crimes investigations into Israel's 3-week attack on the Gaza Strip. Gaza residents continue to live out the repercussions of those attacks. As FSRN's Rami El-Maghari reports, tens of thousands of residents still lack running water.
An estimated 50,000 people in Gaza have not had access to running water since January of this year. Om Youssef is one of them. She lives in the Azbit neighborhood. Her home was destroyed during the Israeli attacks.
We wash clothes once a week. We do the dishes when the water tanker arrives. As for bathrooms, we bring in vessels of water. There are 8 families living here with us. I have 10 kids, and my 7 brothers and their families are all living here as well.
Mohammed Nabhan is a resident of the same neighborhood.
We get water from tanker trucks, and every time we run out, we phone them. But if the tanker doesn't show up, it means no water.
The neighborhood was exposed to a great deal of damage during the Israeli war in Gaza, with dozens of homes demolished and infrastructure networks devastated, including water pipelines. According to the Gaza-based Coastal Municipality's water utility, Israeli army attacks on various parts of the region rendered some 50,000 Palestinian residents with no access to water. The utility says that due to the Israeli closure of Gaza, they haven't been able to bring all of the needed equipment in to repair water lines destroyed during the war. Mondher Shiblak is the general director of the Coastal Municipality's water utility in Gaza.
Yes, we faced during the war and until today a big problem in keeping providing services due to the high restriction on materials accessibility through the borders. I would say that we managed to bring in some materials which we would be happy with, but encourage that. But this is not enough because we are looking at free accessibility of materials if we are talking about in the near future of full recovery of those damages.
In a recent report, the World Bank confirmed massive water disparities between Israel and the occupied territories, even before the January attacks. According to the World Bank, there is, quote, systematic and severe constraints on Palestinian development of water resources, water uses, and wastewater management. Israel controls most of the water resources in Gaza and the West Bank. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
There is a controversial proposal in the Egyptian parliament that would criminalize religious edicts issued by scholars on television if they do not have government permits. Proponents of the draft law say this will help eliminate radical statements made on television. The fear, though, is that this could also lead to government control over religion and curb freedom of speech. FSRN's correspondent Aya Batraoui has more on this from Cairo.
A fatwa in Islam is essentially a religious decree. It's meant to serve as guidance on how to proceed in accordance with God's will. A fatwa may only be issued by a religious scholar called a mufti. So if a Muslim wants to know if something's permissible or punishable in religion, that person turns to the mufti for a fatwa. There are high standards for muftis, who are traditionally men. They must memorize the entire Quran, speak fluent Arabic, understand the life of the Prophet Muhammad, and be knowledgeable about Islamic law. The mufti must also understand the circumstances of people seeking his advice, which is why traditionally a fatwa is issued on an individual basis or to a community by its highest scholar. It's also why each country in the Middle East has its own muftis. But since the explosion of satellite TV and independent channels across the Arab world, people can now simply turn on their television and hear a fatwa being issued that may or may not apply to their particular circumstances. Member of Parliament Mustafa Al-Gindi drives a Hummer and is fluent in both French and English. But he also strongly believes in tradition. Dressed in a crisply ironed navy blue galabeya, once the dress of Egyptian landowners, he explains why he wants to curb this excessive issuing of fatwas to the public.
You cannot do fatwa on TV.
You cannot be a mufti on TV in front of millions of people and one man asks you a question and you answer this man, but maybe the answer you give to this man is not at all the same to the others, because it needs private audience. He has to listen. It's a case.
Al-Ghindi's proposed law could be voted on as early as this summer. It is controversial for two reasons. First, it imposes a 3-year jail sentence to any unauthorized Egyptian issuing a religious decree in the media. Second, some argue it puts too much power in the hands of the government because it requires that a religious scholar must have government approval before issuing a fatwa in the media. According to religious expert Abdulrahman Al-Barr, it is completely in line with Islam to have very high requirements on who can call themselves a mufti. But he is against criminalizing fatwas without government permit. He says, for hundreds of years, greater freedom of speech has been the solution.
If there are many contradicting fatwas, a person should turn to a scholar he feels comfortable with and trust. This is nothing new, and this person can ask more than one trustworthy scholar.
Al-Barr says a mufti who issues a religious decree that ends up harming people can be questioned in Islam. But he argues that imprisoning religious scholars because they don't have government permits is dictatorial.
This is going to be difficult to apply, and it could lead to control because it stipulates who can and who cannot speak, and this is one of the signs of a dictatorship.
To avoid giving the government too much power, independent lawmaker Al-Ghindi proposes there be a 7-person committee made up of both governmental and non-governmental scholars that choose who gets the permits. Al-Ghindi says a committee made up of 7 highly regarded religious scholars will be difficult to bribe.
A lot of people said, Mustafa, but you're going to give the keys of the fatwa to the hand of the government. And I said, listen, guys, they are 7. The government can buy 1, can buy 2, but it can't buy the 7. And if we don't trust ourselves, then nothing can work. We have to trust that these people, together, in front of everybody, they are not going to sell themselves.
The proposal recently made headway after it was deemed constitutionally acceptable and is now just one step away from being sent to Parliament for a vote. But the draft law faces strong opposition by at least 1/3 of independents in Parliament, who some say are members of the politically banned Muslim Brotherhood. And Egypt is not the only country trying to tackle this thorny issue. The UAE drafted a law to counter what some clerics call fatwa chaos. In August, the government there launched a fatwa call center to help standardize the ways in which the public can seek clarification on religious topics. Aya Batraoui, FSRN, Cairo.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headline editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe, Rose Katakchi, and Oscar Hernandez. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Wendy Carrillo, sitting in for Aura Abogado.